It's been years.
1 week since you
looked at
oh. left me on I the thought doorstep.
I thought we were recording.
Oh.
Our new song.
Yeah.
Cover band.
We could be original.
I feel like we could kind of original.
I tried to start a band when I was younger.
We could try to start a band right now.
I took years of piano for Forrest, but I was learning to play the guitar.
I can do saxophone. That's what I did in school, so I got you.
Okay.
I did. Let's see. My dad had a tenor, and then the marching band convinced me to play the baritone sax, and then I really liked playing the alto, so I eventually got one of those, and that's what I mostly played, but back in high school, the baritone saxophone was as tall as I was. And then you got to carry that around in your marching band stuff. So that was quite the workout. But I don't think I've really touched it since because I was, you know, pushed to play music that I didn't want to play. But had it been like one of those things where it's like, hey, figure out what music you want to play, then I would have actually like invested a lot more time into it and enjoyed it more. But I like avoided practicing and everything at all possible because it was just music I didn't care about or whatever. Yeah, so
same. But I can play Animal I've Become by 3 Days Grace.
There you go. See, you got the stuff going, like the music that you want to play. So
yep.
You can record the new intro for our podcast. And then if that works out, we'll have you commissioned for the intro for the Go Rails and Southeast Ruby.
And then it'll just all get taken down off YouTube because it's just that 3 Days Grace song. He knows how to play. Yeah.
Everything we own will be copyrighted.
Love it.
I listened to one 3 Days Grace song.
Which one?
I think it was literally called I Hate Everything About You or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Classic. 1 Days Grace.
That's what I grew up on.
That would have been like way early 2000s, right before I got into my like emo hardcore days.
Yeah. I was into like punk, hardcore, rock, metal, just the dreary stuff.
I feel like when I listened to that song, you would have been like 7 though.
Maybe. But then when I was 14, I was listening to it.
What'd you listen to when you were 7?
I don't know. Probably same Baby thing. Mozart. I really liked
Baby Mozart.
One of my younger brothers was younger. My mom was playing Baby Mozart, Baby Van Gogh all the damn time. I don't even know. I know a lot of, I'm good at art history now.
All right.
So, anyway, yeah. I guess we're all programmers and stuff.
I'm just imagining Baby Mozart as like Baby Mario with his own video game and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Swap out the music. I mean, it's perfect.
I'm sorry. Is that copyrightable? I got too close. Not Nintendo is.
Flew too close to the sun.
Yeah. Jason's YouTube account's going to get a strike.
Yep. Well, it has been a while. I feel like since we've all been together.
It has.
I feel like we've had a lot of weeks of no episodes.
It's been a summer, you know?
It's been a summer. Andrew and I got COVID on our work trip.
Mm-hmm. Super fun.
Yeah.
It was a good bonding experience. We should have given it to you, Chris, and then we could have, you know.
Yeah, you could just put it in an envelope and mail it to me.
Yeah, just lick an envelope and send it.
Like, this is empty glass jar, like when you get this, open it and breathe in really hard.
It's just a bunch of snot
stank breath. Yeah.
Well,
we're supposed to see each other before we all get sick.
Did you ever buy your ticket?
If you had listened to last week's episode, you would know.
That means you didn't. That means you lied to me.
No, I was literally on my phone buying it. I don't know why I was. There was like something in my head was like, just wait to get this ticket. I was worried that I was going to be like down and out after I got back. I think that's partially why. But then I was like, I got back. I was literally looking at plane tickets on the plane going home because they were like, hey, you can get this special
card.
That's
like Inception.
Yeah, I know.
No, right? I was that's where the discount Wi-Fi. Codes are hidden.
Yeah, but then I got under the real seat. Sick.
Yeah.
I was pretty glad I didn't. That would have cost me some money.
Well, we both had COVID. You could just come and suffered together.
And just giving it to your entire family?
They got it.
And being on the plane.
My entire family.
And airport. And Ubers.
Yeah, the airplane. It's a tricky one.
Yeah. Yeah. I just
well, anyway, what's new in programming? What's new in Ruby?
I've been writing so much code and I don't remember any of it.
That's kind of how I feel too, where I've like, I know I wrote a ton of code this week, but I don't remember most of it. one of the things I was doing was this sat in the back of my mind for a while just to do, which is the Access Tenant Gem has a dependency on Request Store. So when you assign the current tenant, it just assigns it to a thread local variable, which is fine. But depending on your web server, the thread might get reused for another request. And that value might stick around more than the request, longer than the request. And that might not be a good thing. So that's why the gem originally depends on the Request Store gem. And that was by old Steve Klabnik. Shout out to him. But he basically implemented in that gem current attributes. That's almost exactly what this does. So I was like, oh, you know what? Current attributes is out. Maybe I'll refactor Access Tenant, drop the dependency, and just use, we already depend on Rails, so might as well try that. Well, I deleted a bunch of stuff and just swapped out them to reference current attributes in the gem, and voila, 3 lines of code, instantiate a class, add 3 attributes, and then the end of the class, and you're done. And all the tests pass and everything, and it works exactly the same. I was surprised. So I tweeted yesterday or the day before about, I wish the Rails docs would show you current attributes was introduced in Rails 5.2. You can kind of use API doc to figure that out because it will show all the versions and where that method may have been moved to as things change and whatever. But the official Rails docs don't have that. And of course, API doc is it doesn't have Rails 7.0, probably won't get 7.1 for a while and whatever. It's not really super well maintained, but it did make me think why don't the Rails docs have just a little note on we introduced this module, just add a little comment there that would get added to the docs or something. It would be nice to reference that because I was if we're going to swap the dependencies, I got to make sure that Access Tenant requires that minimum version, which turned out to be already at 5.2, and 5.2 was when current attributes was introduced. And I was even better. I don't have to I'll probably release a major version because the internals are changing like that. And it shouldn't be a breaking change, but it feels like a big move. So I want people to be just aware of what's happening behind the scenes, but they shouldn't be affected by it at all, which is cool. So the only real hiccup that I don't love about current attributes is that because of the way that web console works, you can't actually inspect those, which feels really annoying. So if you ever do, you need to do that. You got to set an instance variable in your controller or something just to help you with debugging. So that is the one downside, but it's not really a big deal, I don't think. So maybe it will be, I don't know. It depends on how people are debugging things. So we'll see. I don't know if I'll merge it or not. Maybe it was just kind of a experiment of will this work or not?
You went from major version to maybe I'll merge this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'd like
severe de-escalation there.
I'd like to release it, but I'm also I also don't want to create more problems for myself in maintaining this gem. So, and I also would like people to use it, use that branch and actually run it in production or whatever. So I know for sure that there's no issues with it, but yeah, it's an interesting thing. But yeah, it was kind of cool to see Steve Klabnik created current attributes way back when. I forget when this gem was created, but 11 years ago. So yeah, ahead of the game, long way ahead.
That sounds fun. It sounds like an easy bug fix. I wonder what that's like.
Well, we'll see. I don't know. Refactoring code like that's kind of nice. I always enjoy change this thing, drop the dependency. And yeah. I love that. That's always fun.
Yeah. I've been doing a lot of refactoring. Hasn't been that fun.
Yeah. What kind of challenges do you have on your plate? Well,
I think I called Jason 5 times for the same method this week. I'm not lying. It was the same method. I rewrote this method a lot. So yeah, that was a lot of fun. But eventually it turned out pretty great. So
I'm pretty happy with where it got to.
I'm happy with where it got to. That was good. But it was polymorphic across multiple models to finally get to this other model. And then that model needed scopes. And then they were like, but then we want to know different things and like blah, blah, blah. And like, we want to paginate it. And we're like, but this is an array. Oh, this is what I learned this week, because I found it. I had to change the method again, but we had to return an array. One of the earlier iterations of this method, when we really wanted an active record collection. But slowly but surely, we, after multiple phone calls and multiple rewritings of it, we eventually did write it into an active record relation. And then we were able to call our scopes and stuff. But then we were like, then they made a new change. And they're like, well, if blah, blah, blah doesn't occur, we don't want to return anything from this method. And the current state, the method was returning everything. Everything when this certain related object wasn't present. And I was like, how am I going to do this? Because we passed this object to Pagey, and I had changed all the Pagey stuff to use Pagey countless instead of Pagey array. Everything was so much faster. I was lazy loading in this stuff. It was like the performance was drastically improving. And then I'm like, crap, now what do I do? And then thanks to ChatGPT, I learned you can do user.none will return an empty active record collection for a user object. Like, that's just an example.
Yep,
like, so yep. I basically did, and that wasn't a user object, but for this example, I was doing like return user.none, and that could be passed to Pagey, and then all
it's our, a
like,
collection.
Like, yep.
Yeah, an empty collection.
An empty collection object.
It's hilarious to see methods like that in the documentation where you're like, who the hell would ever use this? Like, when you first see it and you're like, why would I want a method that returns nothing? And then you actually need it in production somewhere and you're like, whoa, this is genius. It yeah. sounded stupid, but actually it is the guest user pattern kind of thing or whatever. What's the name for that?
My null object.
Yeah, null object pattern. Yes. Yeah. It's basically that. And it's like perfect. And you're like, wow, all the conditionals that I had to have before gone. Yep. Everything just works. And it's just a,
yeah,
you know, direct line of operations instead of like branches now, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that stuff, but it's so funny to read it for the first time and you're like, the hell? Why would we ever want this? But
yeah, it saved me from so many, like I was already going through and starting adding conditionals and stuff to like, okay, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I got to remove all of that and just change that one line. I felt pretty, pretty good.
Oh yeah.
Good.
The change from an array to an active record collection, I can't tell you how much that unlocked for us. It's still not the most performant SQL even, but it is so much better than the method we were doing before. So like, it was worth the extra 2 to 3 hours of
That's awesome.
Rewriting.
I got a little bit more performant with, I was like, how can I make this even faster? Cause like, it was slowing down the page because it's just a complex query and we weren't loading it efficiently from the beginning. So like, until we got to this place where now it's like much more efficient, I was like, how can we improve the speed like immediately? And I was like, well, technically these objects are hidden behind a button. Like, you have to show them with a button. And I was like, now when you click that button, we'll load this instead of when the page loads, like we'll use Turbo to like load those objects in rather than like loading it when the whole page loads and just having it hidden. And that made it infinitely faster as well.
That's cool.
Infinitely faster?
Infinitely. But it cut it in half.
Half of infinity. Still infinity, so.
That's true.
Technically correct.
What about infinity over cosine?
You know, I actually used Ruby Infinity the other day.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, but the other day, I mean like 5 months ago.
Okay.
When I built.
Feels like the other day.
Yesterday.
Feels like the other day. When I built the limits for Jobboardly based on the plan you're on, there's a certain beta status people can have where they can have unlimited job posts or like on the top tier. And so I just used Ruby's number infinity or whatever to represent that. And it works amazing because like it works with math and stuff. You don't get some kind of like error where you have to account for nil or use like -1 to represent infinity. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is almost another null object kind
of thing. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Infinity is not zero though. It's zero and nothing.
Well, all I'm going to say is after 10 years, I finally got to use infinity in Ruby. So
nice.
I'm going to start looking at what it's going to take to retire.
After all that math that they taught us about infinity, like I've done so much math with infinity.
Infinity's on the float class as a constant. Is that right?
We be floating.
Because I always thought that was interesting. You know, it's not just a constant in Ruby itself. It's like under float. It's like not an integer because infinity could be any.
It's not a real number.
Yeah. It could be any number of decimals. It doesn't have to be just an integer. I wonder if there's any, I guess you could alias integer infinity to float infinity.
We do not recommend, the Room That Ruby podcast does not recommend you follow.
Disclaimer.
This is not an advice.
But yeah, I always thought that was interesting where it's like under float for whatever reason. I'm sure there's a reason for that because infinity can include whatever decimals or whatever, but
right. Yeah. That makes sense. It's been great though, because like you do infinity minus 100, it just returns infinity, but you can then say like infinity dot positive, which is actually the math I'm doing. Like how many more job posts can you have? Well, even if you have 1,000, infinity minus 1,000 is infinity, and that's still positive. So you've still got plenty of room. It's slick. It's cool.
Yeah. When you can use it like that, then it's basically like replacing a number. As long as you're writing your code with that in mind, the way you write it will end up working perfect, and you don't have, again, more like, oh, if it's nil, then it assume that, you know, it's infinity. You don't have to deal with that stuff.
Case statements like -1, it's unlimited.
Yeah.
That's the kind of code I want to write. Like Avi Grimm's written and talked a lot about that type of like programming. And like, I know we've talked about patterns a lot and how we don't necessarily use all of them, but that type of programming is very fascinating to me because the less conditional logic I have, the happier my mind is.
Yep. It is 100% because you have less tests to write. You can guarantee that code is like, if it executes, you may have to throw different values in there and make sure that the operations in that order are still correct, but you reduce the complexity, like, because you also don't have to write near as many tests because there are less branches and yada, yada, yada. Like, it just infinitely improves your code quality so much. It's awesome. I had a little thing like that the other day where I was thinking about when you're talking about pagination, we have our custom like API client helper in Jumpstart Pro. And one thing I've not added until this week was like a with pagination method, but it's like not really an easy thing to implement because you have pagination in APIs sometimes is a key in your JSON, sometimes the link header like GitHub uses. And then there are plenty of other ways to implement pagination for APIs. And so I was like, well, how do we build a generic with pagination method that you could wrap? So what we ended up doing was a handful of experiments and like trying to figure out what the syntax should be. But basically we like wrote with pagination, you give it the same arguments that you would for your first GET request. And then we'll yield to a block the response from the previous page. So you can pull out the results from that. Because again, you're using APIs. So sometimes it might return an array of whatever items, but it also might be like projects as a key. And then you have to go into that to get the array of items. And so we were like, how we got to make this all generic. So we just yield the response for the previous page. You can grab the items out of it, add them to an array, yield them to another block, whatever you might want to do. And then all you have to do in that block is return the string for the next URL or a hash of parameters for the URL. And we'll just replace that with like page 2, page 3, page 4. And like you can go and pull that out of the request however you need to. And just give us the next details. We'll just like either replace the URL with a new one or modify it with the new pagination stuff. And it works like a dream. It's so simple to use, but it took us like 5 iterations. And one of them, the first thing was like, well, what if we collect all the results for you and you give us the current array of items and then you give us like a inside of that, maybe a hash that's like, here's results, here's the next page URL. But that got us into this thing where we were like, well, if you give us a next page URL, we'll use that. If that's nil or an empty string, we need to look at the next page query key and see, is that nil or whatever? And if both of those are nil, then we can return from the method and stuff. And it was like one of those cases where like, yeah, starting to get a lot of if statements here for stuff that we don't really want. It's just getting complicated. So refactoring ended up on that solution where it was like, hey, give us a string or a hash. And we do have one branch, which is the case statement, but it's like, if it's a string, we'll use this as the URL. If it's a hash, we'll just modify the query params and voila. So it turned out really nice, but it was one of those moments where I was like, yeah, if statements, I don't like these things.
Yeah, I like to avoid conditionals if I can.
I don't think you succeeded in that one.
I'll stand by it.
I just want to take a second to thank our sponsor, Honey Badger. Monitoring like web development can be complicated. There are tons of tools and techniques, but you just want to know that your app is up and your customers are happy. When your customers encounter a problem, you need clear, actionable intelligence, not walls of charts and reams of logs to tell. That's why they built Honey Badger, the monitoring tool we've always wanted. A tool that's there when you need it and gets out of your way when you don't, so you can keep shipping. Know when critical errors occur and which customers are affected. Respond instantly when your systems go down. Improve the health of your systems over time. And fix problems before your customers can report them. I know from personal experience, I've fixed bugs when they've shown up in Honey Badger and then emailed the customer to let them know, hey, I think I saw you get a 500 error. I've fixed it. And I just wanted to let you know you can try again. And it blows those customers' minds to see that they didn't even have a chance to report the bug to you. It's wild. They love it. Honey Badger is the application health monitoring tool built for you, the developer who cares about a quality product and happy customers. Start monitoring today at honeybadger.io. It's free for small teams and setup takes as little as 5 minutes. Once again, that's honeybadger.io. Do you feel like when you're learning programming that...
Oh my God, where is this going?
Well, I was just thinking about like when people are learning programming, like I remember myself when I'm trying to write code and figure out a problem, I'm thinking about like, well, if there's this situation, we need to handle that. And then if it's this situation, and my brain kind of thinks in if statements when I'm breaking down a problem. And that's usually how my code ends up, with a crap load of if statements. And I remember like a friend of mine in school showed me this like app he wrote that he was proud of. And it was like 5 or 10 nested if statements. And I was like, I have no idea what this is doing. And I will never understand it because there's so much nested stuff. But I could see he's thinking through the problem, but he's writing every one of those thoughts down as another if statement and an else case and whatever. And it just got me thinking about that.
I mean,
I feel like
the way you're taught.
Yeah.
Programming.
So I was working with my little brother who's in computer science school. And
did he listen to Baby Mozart?
Yeah, it was him. I was looking at his code and I was like, there's so many if statements in here. But as I was kind of thinking about it, I was like, they don't really teach that many flow operate, like control operators at that level, right? They definitely teach you if, because that's like in every programming language in some form or fashion. But when you start getting like into a more advanced level, like you start to realize, oh, well, instead of using if statements, like I could just compose classes, for instance, and use send or use metaprogramming and like learn how to use object-oriented programming instead of using all these if statements. It's hard for someone new to know how to do that if like the purpose of them, because they're just learning how to like create algorithms from the beginning.
Yeah, you're not used to thinking in terms other than if else.
Yeah. The basic types of problems they give them. Yeah. It's a lot of like kind of brain teaser type Archimedes pyramid or whatever.
In my CS one class or whatever, the first day he's like, I'm sure you've heard this example, but it's like, how do I make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? And you've got to like tell them how to do it, but they like try to get you to think and like, well, you actually have to get the peanut butter out of the closet. Like you have to tell it how to do everything. That is a really good intro.
It's another good exercise too of like, and this is probably all of learning programming, but like the assumptions that you make are not obvious until you start writing code and you're like, oh man, when we tell you how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, we assume that you already have all the ingredients. They're right here. And it's like, well, actually, if you really start at the beginning, you've made a lot of assumptions. And it's like just drawing attention to, like, I guess how your brain probably works pre-programming. And then afterwards, it's like much more attuned to those things.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to learn how to break down problems. I think that's kind of really what it is. Like, but yeah, you learn how to break them down into such a level. The big thing I was trying to teach my brother was like, turn the problem into like an algorithm. When this happens, then this happens. And then once you start outlining and like get an idea of it, it is a lot easier to write. But like assumptions can really be damaging. Like even now, I waste time and I've been catching myself doing this because of assumptions. I see a bug, I have an assumption about the way things are. And then I like waste time and then maybe run things in production and think like, oh yeah, I fixed this bug. And then you go back and you're like, I made a fatal assumption here. And because of that, the rest of this is now inaccurate.
Yeah. And it is also like, if somebody gives you like a designer or somebody gives you requirements for like, hey, build this feature. And you're like, hold on a second. You made some assumptions here that now if you tell me X, then I can go build it right away. But if you say Y, then it is a whole different thing to build. And it can be so subtle. It's wild when you're looking at it. But I feel like there was one moment that I always remember or think back to. Like, you know, if somebody asked you to like parameterize a blog post title or something, if you're a beginner, you might be like, okay, I have the string. I can go through every character. I can like downcase capital letters A through Z. And then if I hit a space, I'll replace that with a hyphen or whatever. And then somebody asks you like, okay, well, what if there's a duplicate? Then you got to figure out, do I generate like the URL with the ID at the end? And I forget where I saw it, but someone had an example of like, let's actually build an array and let's put the ID in there first. And then let's put the title in there. And then maybe if you have a duplicate, you put a thing at the end or whatever. And using those little simple text manipulation examples in showing like, if you need to parameterize something and they say, oh, now you need to put the ID in there. Okay, well, we just toss these in an array. If there's optional things, we can append it, but we can skip it if we need to. And then just join by hyphens at the end. Those were like moments where I was like, what? You can do this? And it was just
it's empowering.
Like mind blowing. Cause you're like, I would have written basically if statement, if ID is present, then we include it. Otherwise we don't. And you might end up with like ternaries inside of the string interpolation or something crazy, or just shove it all in. And that's another one where you're like, oh, if the ID is present, then we'll put it in the array. Like, what if you just put it in the array and it might be nil and you just call the array.compact and then .join with a hyphen. And then you're like, what? It removed even more if statements. Those were just like mind-blowing things that I very fondly remember changing my entire perspective on writing code.
I've often wondered in the last few years what it would be like to learn programming using a functional language as your first language. And if that would shape the world a little differently for you.
Probably. Yeah.
I'm sure it would.
Because you think in terms of like functions that don't change any state in a, and I'm air quoting here, in a perfect world, like a pure function, you know, you give it an input and the output's always the same. Sure, there's still conditional logic in this, but I just think it's fascinating.
That reminds me of like, we had to learn Haskell in one of our computer science classes. And
was it a hassle?
Haskell, a hassle.
That's what you do to me every time I drop these sweet ass dad jokes. So
did it for you, Jason.
That's the second one you've done. I'm really proud of you, actually. Yours really good.
Anyway,
so good. Chris,
you're talking about Haskell.
I think it was one where there's quite a few languages. Ruby doesn't do this, but where you can define the same method name with different arguments.
Overloading. And
yeah. And so like if you have a join method or something and it's like, oh, you give us two strings. Okay, we'll do it this way. And the implementation ends up where, if you look at the link to helper in Rails, that's a good example of one that's like, well, you could give us a string first, but if you don't give us a string, or if you give us a title and the URL, we can use that. But if you give us a block, then you can give us the URL first, and then this moves. Yeah. But if you look at the source code for that, it's got to actually do some checking there and see, like, if block given, then we need to reassign these variables, and the variable names now are like title or link, and it can't know unless you check to see if you've been given a block. And that is something that's pretty awesome in those other languages, that you can just have the link to method defined multiple times. It removes any conditionals that are like, well, we need to process these differently because of those argument types or numbers of arguments or whatever. And it's like generally not a big deal in Ruby, but it's one where, like, looking at the link to implementation could have been a little bit easier to do that. And hell, one of them, well, it'd be interesting, but you could almost have like the block version, just eval the block, then call the other implementation with the string and, you know, the URL as the first two arguments. One's almost just a wrapper around the other or whatever, but it's interesting just to see how languages are defined like that, or decisions are made.
That's something I know we talked to Jose before, but like Elixir is really good at, because it's not just overloading, like, it's pattern matching the arguments too. Like, I always thought that was cool, right? Because in a way that replaces conditionals, because it's like, okay, if this method doesn't take an argument, we need to do something different. Or like it's blank or nil or whatever. But where it like really blew my mind is doing recursion, because then you just keep calling the same method, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to use the same method. Because usually, like with recursion, you finally get to the end of something if you're lucky. And so you just have a method handles that case. So you have like different methods based on how it's like filtering down. I think it's
because you end up with that final one that's just like, you give me this, I just return whatever, and then it breaks down everything else.
Yep.
And that is, that is super cool. Any techniques you can learn to remove conditionals are a huge win. I was just showing Andrew Hodson the other day the presence method that Active Support adds.
The other Andrew.
I like snapped my head to the right. I was like, me? Are they talking about me?
What? But that one is like awesome, because there are so many times where you're like, well, if this is present, I want to use it. Otherwise, I want to fall back to this other thing. And if it's present, I want to use that. Or I might need to fall back to a third default value. And if you've got to like write that out, you like create a temporary variable. You check if the first thing is true, then you assign it to there. And then it's a mess of if statements. But presence just gives a little, I mean, the implementation of it is beautiful. It says self if present. And so it just returns itself or nil. And by giving a name to that, you can strip out, there's still if statements going on, but you've given it a name, and the way that it works, you can just chain it with the ors, and voila, your code doesn't have any if statements. They're still happening behind the scenes, but it is a very elegant solution instead. And it's just another one of those like pro tips that you start to learn. But yeah, it got us down the rabbit hole on conditionals are bad, but they bad.
I don't even know what we started with.
We started by singing a song.
Well, that's true.
But yeah, yeah.
Guard clauses are good, but guard clauses can be abused.
Okay, sure, but anything can be abused. I like guard clauses a lot. I'll take a guard clause over conditional.
I mean, isn't a guard clause conditional?
If you think about it like that, but you know.
If you think about it like that. I like them a lot if there's like a lot of like logic in the method or whatever, like more than like a couple lines. But if it is one where it's do this or that, if it's short, I'll probably write the full if statement in there instead of a guard clause, but they can be super handy.
It's just something you need to guard against.
I write them everywhere. So
yeah, literally he was texting me the other day, like return if.
Yeah. For me, whatever reason, a guard clause is easier to read than an if statement, or especially an unless statement.
No, my former coworker and I guess subsequently friend, Kyle Fox, once linked me to a Python something where they talk about like the importance of clarity, essentially. And like the return statements, like the guard clauses, were actually an example of that. Like, it is easier here to say these three conditions, like return each time. It's like easier to parse through that than the inverse of if conditionals. And I was like, that's something that stuck with me. And Kyle's still my friend, but I just,
yeah, because they're work with him. They're usually one liners. I thought you were going to introduce him as my former coworker and former friend. So,
well, I guess that's what I meant by subsequently like former friends, but he doesn't listen to this. He'll be fine.
So that's why I'll send it to him. Same.
Well, we'll just send him this clip.
That's fine. Every time something goes wrong at work, I always blame Kyle. And then Spencer always takes a screenshot of it and sends it to Kyle in a group thread.
I've even seen his name a lot.
I think guard clauses are really helpful when it's like, yo, if it's any of these situations, kick it back out. You see all of that real tightly packed versus if you had to break those into a giant if statement in your method, then it can be harder to scan that because you might have 10 lines of code to process one of those conditions. Right. But the rest of them are like a one-liner return. Well, if this is empty, then return nil or whatever. Like, yeah, you might as well bunch those together in one spot.
So, yeah, and the best way to solve that would be to have the same method multiple times based on the argument.
Yeah, that's the stuff that's really cool is like the pattern matching stuff where it's like, oh, you can even peek into a hash or something and say, oh, does it have this key? Then we'll process it this way. And if it doesn't, then we'll do it another way. And that stuff is super cool because that's what you were going to have to do inside your code anyways. So it's like, well, we might as well just make the language do it real fast or whatever. It's pretty sweet. But maybe there's also the trade-off of like, well, if you're going to redefine a method 14 different ways, and you decide to change the logic of how that works, then you might have to change your code 14 different times for those. So
how dare you use reason and logic right now?
Colin can teach us C and we'll just move on to the C world.
C world. No, I'm
we do need a programming conference at SeaWorld.
Is SeaWorld even a thing anymore?
I think it's a place. So? I think it's still there, but people don't like the captivity and stuff. So it's not as exciting anymore.
Yeah, there's one in Orlando, one in San Diego, one in San Antonio.
Oh.
Yeah. They've gotten a lot of negativity from that, which is understandable.
Is that why the second thing on their website is SeaWorld is one of the largest marine animal rescue organizations in the world?
Yeah, that's exactly why. That's cap, dude. That is cap.
We can go Photoshop their site and they're rescuing animals and developers.
We just copy their source control. If they don't have cross-site, depending on the way their assets are served, we can just use their style sheets. Call it SeaWorld.io.
Jason, have you had a need ever? It's been this long to use Infinity. Have you implemented anything that needs the Batman constant, not a number?
What are you speaking right now? What is this? Dark Knight Rises variable in Ruby?
What's his name? Gary Bernhardt that did that JavaScript thing. And it was like, you know, random things he would do in JavaScript would return like not a number or whatever. And then, of course, like if you do multiple not a numbers together, it's na-na-na-na-na-na, you know, Batman. So that's why it's the Batman constant.
Do two not a numbers make a number?
No.
Unless you... I think it makes zero. Well,
can't you, like, do multiplication with infinity?
Yeah.
So what's that? Oh, God, infinity. I'm getting, like, flashbacks to calculus. I don't want to go here. Jason, you're starting a conference, right? Let's talk about that. Let's not talk about math.
Yeah, we can talk about that.
End
with that. Yeah, bringing back old Southeast Ruby.
Excellent.
And that's all the details I have so far.
Well, nice. You have one other detail. It's going to be in Memphis, right?
In Memphis, not Nashville. I think I've said this before. I know I've told you all. It's just hard to put on a conference in a city you don't live in.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
So, going to bring it to Memphis. I have Ernie Miller helped me organize the last couple, and he told me today he's in. Awesome. So I need to get with him, but I have some ideas to make it different from the other Southeast Rubies.
I'm not coming to Memphis as long as Jaws there.
Oh my God.
My life is in danger.
Oh my God. Anyway, well, he'll be
Bozo.
I guess he'll be playing again by the time it happens. But yeah.
Oh hell, maybe.
Maybe. I still want talks, but I really want to
rescue marine animals.
Be the world's leading marine animal rescue. Yes. I really want to like drive home the community part of it. I want to like,
you want to drive us each home? So yes. If we come from St. Louis, you're going to drive me home personally.
That's our trip.
I like it.
I'm just, that's what actually what Southeast Ruby is. What a
unique conference idea.
You fly to Memphis and we get in a big RV and I just go on a tour taking everyone back home.
Actually be fun. Maybe not in this context, but
whoever gets taken home first gets the like worst deal. But then whoever's the last drop off, they get the most out of their ticket.
Yeah. Whoever comes from Memphis is screwed. But
well, ideally you'd go all the way to the last spot and then work your way back, where if you could do that.
I have some ideas for it. I'll talk about more, but I'm thinking the problem I have right now is at least this year, there were like 21 Ruby conferences in the fall in Europe. Now, I don't think there's a lot of overlap between people coming to Southeast Ruby and people in Europe, but it does have me thinking maybe I'll do it in the spring, or like, I guess it would be late winter, but very early 2024.
Will there be snow? Yes or no?
It snows once a year here, so it is possible.
Okay.
I'm allergic to snow, so.
You're allergic to clouds.
Yes.
They're made out of snow. So.
Yes. I think that's
what they're both white.
I think
it's basically like cloud dandruff.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want the clouds peeing on me. It's crazy.
That's exciting. So you're thinking like first quarter or something?
Yeah, I'm thinking February right now because Sweat's bringing Sin City back in March and I will be speaking at Sin City. I think that will be announced by then. So like I'll need a little bit of a gap between the two. So
yeah. Well, I'm happy to help. It is not in my city, but I'm coming down and happy to help wherever I can. I miss it a lot. That was a lot of fun. The last couple. Are there any cool venues in Memphis? I know you haven't picked anything yet, but
there's a
you
had few picked out
the Ruby, whatever you call that little place.
We'll never top a venue called Ruby hosting a Ruby conference.
Yeah, that was cash money.
Cash money.
There's a couple places... There's a couple of places. One is
Python.
Cool. It's by the lake.
It's called JavaScript.
Yes.
We'll just start a chain of, oh yeah, there we go. O'Charlie's Conf.
Oh, I think, I don't know. We may have one O'Charlie's left. There's a couple of places. I probably won't do it downtown. There's a cool spot in Midtown. They just built this hotel that's by a really cool venue that I want to do that, but also by a ton of restaurants. So like it'd be a really good little area for people to like post up in.
Nice.
There's a place out east. We have a thing called Shelby Farms. It's a bunch of just grass, basically, but it's an outdoors area. People go work out and stuff. There's a lake there and a restaurant. And next to the restaurant's a little mini conference center. I actually went to a Solidus conference there once. So,
oh, wow.
But I don't know. There's some ideas. There's some cool places. You can fly into Memphis by going through any major city. Andrew can come direct from Phoenix, but
yeah, just in case anyone was worried.
Well, we know how much you hate layovers.
Yeah, I do hate layovers.
Yeah. Are you going to target 100 people or 150 or maybe the venue kind of decides that a little bit?
Here's my dream. I'm in the like 50 to 100 range. The sweet spot for me is I don't make any money. I don't lose any money and it's still affordable for people to come to. And so that's what I'm aiming for. And I think I can pull that off in Memphis. And so ideally, you know, we could get 40, 50 people here.
Yeah. I really, really like the small conferences like that. You just like get to meet everybody and hang out with everyone, which is awesome.
Yep. Like the last one I went to that I can think of that was like smaller was Sin City last year. And I have a lot of really fond memories from that conference.
It was a great conference.
So, I don't know. That and all the conferences popping back up just has me wanting to have a conference in the Southeastern United States again.
Yeah. So excited. I can't wait.
Yeah. I never got to go to one. So well, I'm excited.
We'll change that as long as they don't add a layover to your flight.
Yeah. God forbid. I'll just drive at that point.
Drive the bus.
Except I'd have to drive through Texas, which, or West Texas specifically, which I swore on my life I would never do again. So,
yeah, well, that's exciting. I'm sure we'll have more updates on all that. Once you figure out dates, and it's not like the venues probably have a lot of bookings for February. So,
yeah,
it's not a prime wedding season or anything like that.
Probably it will be hot here.
That's excellent.
Because when it's hot here, it's humid and it's gross.
Yeah, that's not the fun kind of warm.
Back sweat.
Oh, yeah. Like, oh, I'm getting stressed out just thinking about it. Anyway, we'll talk more about it.
But sweet.
It was good to talk Ruby with you for a little bit today.
Good to talk Ruby with you and also with you.
Great to talk Ruby with you and with you. And Ruby be with you as well.
Praise be.